Human intelligence is a remarkable resource, unmatched by that of any other creature we have ever encountered. Your brain can use language to communicate, do math, memorize the route to the grocery store, and learn to ride a bike to get you there. So it's not easy to be impressed by simpler forms of cognition, like a single-celled organism that senses an energy source and directs itself toward that. But let's be clear. Without that sort of mind on planet Earth, one that doesn't possess a single neuron, your magnificent mind would not be possible. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We can actually learn a lot about our own abilities by directing our attention to the evolutionary processes that started billions of years ago, and my guest is here to help us do that. Ogi Ogas was a Department of Homeland Security fellow at the Department of Cognitive and Neural Systems at Boston University and a research fellow at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. His new book, written with co-author Sai Gadam, is called Journey of the Mind, How Thinking Emerged from Chaos. Ogi, welcome to Think.
Chris, I am thrilled to be here.
Do we need to start by talking about what counts as a mind? Like, we're all so familiar with the things our minds do for us. It can be easy to overlook the fact that other creatures have their own versions.
I'd say the single most important takeaway from going on the journey of the mind, retracing the 3 billion year journey of thinking on Earth, is this. The mind is activity, not a thing. This distinction between being an activity and being a thing has tripped up more scientists and scholars than any other aspect of studying the mind. The word mind is an action noun, like game or dance or hurricane. And the activity of the mind is thinking. Thinking is what a mind does. So let me share with you our definition of thinking in the book, because this definition doesn't only explain how we're going to tackle the mind in Journey of the Mind, it reveals some important details, some important properties of all that all minds have in common, and that really defines what a mind is. So our definition of thinking is this. Thinking is the conversion of sensory inputs from the environment into behavioral outputs that affect the environment. And crucially, these outputs must influence the health and welfare of a body. So thinking is the conversion of inputs into outputs that benefit a body. Now, this definition might seem a little simple or even trivial, but it actually accomplishes and shines a spotlight on several crucial things about all minds. First, this definition underscores again that the mind is activity. The mind is doing stuff. It's converting inputs into outputs. You know, we shouldn't think of the mind as neurons or neurotransmitters or fancy brain structures with Latin names. It's the activity, the interaction. Also, this definition emphasizes the hidden connectedness of all minds. This simple definition, converting sensory inputs into behavioral outputs to benefit a body, accurately describes all the minds that exist in the universe, from the tiniest minds of, say, the archaea and the bacteria, tiny microscopic single-celled minds, all the way up to the most gargantuan minds on the planet, which is not the individual human brain. I'm sure we'll talk later about what the most powerful mind on the planet is. But all of these are united by converting sensory inputs into a behavioral output. But this simple definition also underscores the core dynamic in all minds. All minds at their heart have a beating heart. That beating heart is a loop. And our definition points us to that loop. The loop is this. Sensory inputs from the environment get processed by the mind, turn into behavioral outputs that affect the environment, but now the environment's changed because the mind has changed it. And so the next input that comes in is going to be different as a result of the behavior of the mind. This is sometimes called the perception action loop. Some people call it the perception action cycle, but this loop from the environment to the mind back to the environment, that is the heart of every mind, whether you're talking about a bacteria mind, whether you're talking about a frog mind, whether you're talking about a human mind, or even the mind of a city or a country. Yes, in our book, we do argue that cities and countries can think and be conscious just like we are. And one reason is because they have at their heart this fascinating, powerful loop, taking in information from the environment and converting it into action that changes the environment.
Okay, so you mentioned these tiny creatures called archaea, these single-celled microbes. They were able to sense the presence of light and move toward it. And this makes them dynamic to the extent that they're able to change along with their environment?
So the simplest minds, such as the mind of the bacteria or the minds of archaea, they are very basic. They don't do a lot of learning. They mostly just move towards a goal. They take in some inputs from their environment. They sense for food. They sense for toxins. Sometimes they sense for things like salt, the salinity of the water, if they're in water, the brightness of light. They sense these stimuli from their environment and automatically go off. Either if it's food, they'll move towards the food. If it's a toxin, they'll move away from the toxin. So there's very little development or learning or adaptation in these tiny, tiny minds. There's just not enough room. They don't have enough complexity to do a lot of learning. But one interesting thing about these tiny, tiny minds, and keep in mind, these tiny creatures like bacteria and archaea, protozoa, the thinking elements, the things doing the thinking in these minds are individual molecules. We can identify the specific individual molecules in these tiny creatures that are responsible for thinking. But these thinking elements in these tiny minds, these molecules, are the only thinking elements in minds on Earth that do not change or learn. That is, these simplest minds on Earth are made of thinking elements that are fixed and unchanging. A single molecule, for example, in some bacteria, they have a molecule called tar. It's a single molecule. It's on the membrane of bacteria that detects certain kinds of nutrition in the environment. So the molecule of tar on its own is fixed. It does not change. It does not learn or does not adapt. As we get to more complicated minds, we get new kinds of thinking elements. For example, the neuron. And the neurons and other thinking elements do change and do learn. So here at the smallest level of the mind, there's not much learning, there's not much changing, but yet there is definitely thinking.
All right, Ogi, the first neuron-minded creature you introduce in the book is this Hydra vulgaris, which is still very tiny, but vastly larger than an amoeba. Where are its neurons located and what specific challenge do they meet?
Yes, Chris. So as you mentioned, the Hydra, which is closely related to jellyfish, and it does resemble almost an upside down jellyfish. It's just a rubbery stalk with some tentacles hanging off of it, sort of like a little feather duster. But it is the tiniest multicellular creature that we describe in Journey of the Mind. And it is the simplest creature with neurons. And what's interesting about the Hydra's neurons is that they are entirely decentralized. There is no brain. There's no centralized controller. Its neurons are distributed pretty evenly throughout its body. And it has two layers of neurons. It's very simple. It has sensor neurons, which take in stimuli from the environment. And it has doer neurons, muscle neurons, neurons that activate the muscles that cause the Hydra to move. And yet with this simple neural network, sensor neurons, which are tied into networks of doer neurons, the Hydra is able to do simple motions. It can contract its stalk, it can extend its stalk, it can flex its tentacles. It has a mouth in the center of its tentacles. It can open and close that. And here is what's so interesting and important about the Hydra as a mind. And what sets it apart from the molecule minds that came before and also distinguishes it from the minds that came after. And it's this, the Hydra mind is capable of multitasking. The Hydra has multiple limbs. It has multiple tentacles and it has a mouth and it has a stalk and it can operate all of these at the same time. This is revolutionary in amoebas, in bacteria, in archaea, in other protozoa. They can only do one thing at once. It can move towards food or it can move away from toxins. It can't do both. But the Hydra can grab one thing with one tentacle and grab something else with another tentacle. It can move its stalk while moving its mouth at the same time. It can chew gum and walk at the same time. So this expands mind, it opens up a whole new world for minds, because after the Hydra, the fact that it can execute multiple purposes at the same time means that the mind can start expanding in all kinds of ways, can start thinking about different things at the same time, and that's going to quickly increase the power.
Okay, on to the roundworm. What allows a roundworm to make rudimentary decisions?
So the Hydra that we just talked about faces a problem. And the problem stems from the fact that it does not have any kind of centralized control. So even though the Hydra can multitask, even though it can wave its tentacles while it moves its stalk, it can't coordinate these. So it can't coordinate the movement of its tentacle with the stalk. Or it can't, for example, move all of its tentacles towards the same object. Maybe there's a prey floating by. It can't say, hey, I'll capture that prey by moving all of my tentacles, in a circle around the prey. So there is a limit, a ceiling on how smart a creature with a mind like this can be. And in fact, jellyfish and hydras are the smartest creatures with this kind of mental architecture. And in order to become any more intelligent, any smarter, to succeed better in the world, the Hydra had to figure out how to do centralized control. And the roundworm, as you pointed out, is the simplest creature in the journey of the mind that has centralized control. It doesn't have a brain yet, but it has a very, very simple circuit in the center of its mind. Specifically, it has a set of 10 neurons located in its head between. It has two networks of doer neurons that control motion, two locomotion networks down its two sides that control the worm's ability to move, to wriggle forward, to wriggle backwards. And between these two networks are these 10 thinker neurons, these decider neurons that help the roundworm make decisions. This centralized circuit uses a kind of mental dynamic known as winner take all. So basically, these 10 thinker neurons all compete with each other. Each of them wants to do something different. So one neuron maybe wants to go forward, another neuron wants to go backwards, another neuron wants to wave the head back and forth. Each neuron wants to do a different task, a different purpose. And so the neurons compete with each other. Whichever neuron has the greatest motivation, the greatest activation, wins out and takes control of the entire mind. So if the neuron that wants to go forward beats the neuron that wants to go backward, then the worm goes forward. But this is the emergence of centralized control. It's not yet the brain, but this is the seed that will lead to brains in future creatures.
Okay, so next we meet a flatworm, which I hope you'll forgive me for not realizing represents a huge evolutionary leap forward in that it has this ability to perceive. It's also, I think, the first creature we meet that has anything like a discernible head that we could recognize.
That's right. So the flatworm, it's a little bigger than the roundworm, and it's actually older than the roundworm. I think it's, I might be getting the years wrong, but I think it's at least 100 million years older than the roundworm, and yet it is smarter. And the reason it is smarter is because it's the first creature that has networks of thinker neurons. It has a network of neurons that do not directly interact with the environment. They do not reach out to the environment, and they do not interact with, they're not in charge of executing actions. So they sit between sensors, which sense stimuli from the environment, and doers, which execute actions. So the flatworm is the first creature with a network of thinker neurons, and we have a more familiar name for it. It's known as a brain. The flatworm is the simplest creature on Earth that has a brain, a specific organ dedicated to thinking. And from this point forward, this is what's really interesting about the flatworm. It's the first time that the body changes to support the mind rather than the mind changing to support the body. So, in all the creatures before this, in archaea, bacteria, protozoa, hydras, roundworms, the mind adapted to the physical structure of the body. But now that the brain's emerged, the body is going to start changing to support the brain. And the most immediate way we see that in the flatworm is we see eyes, or more specifically, eye spots. They're not fully developed eyes yet, but we see the first sensory organs, the first perceptual organs, physical structures on the head that help with vision. It also has something, the flatworm also has something called auricles, which even though the word auricle refers to sound, they actually smell, they sniff. So it's all olfactory sense. So this is the first creature where now it looks like a head and things are changing on the head in order to support the mind. And from here on out, we're going to see more and more changes in bodies to help support the mind. So the mind is now going to start becoming the master of the body. So far, that's not the case. The body's been the master, but now the flatworm represents this critical turning point where the mind is going to start taking control of things.
How does this innovation of representation allow flies to solve the unique challenges of their own existence?
So insects are the smartest creatures on Earth that are not conscious. Now, there's a very, we can explain exactly why they're smart, but not conscious. And it's this: insects have very developed networks of neurons, and these networks are highly specialized. So for example, the fruit fly has a module. Again, a module is our term for a specialized neural network that does a specific function. So the fruit fly has, for example, a visual recognition network that recognizes visual patterns. It has a motor control network that controls its movements. It has a evaluation module that evaluates whether a particular stimulus is desirable or potentially harmful. So the problem, though, was that once you have specialized modules, they need a way to communicate with each other. Single neuron to neuron communications will no longer cut it when you have these complicated sophisticated modules. So as you pointed out, they solve this through mental representation. So a representation is a pattern of activity that represents a stimuli or a concept or a value. And representations are the key to the next stage of minds, the module minds. So what, now we're going to get to one of the most fascinating and important things in the journey of the mind, this transition from insects to fish, this transition from invertebrates to vertebrates, this transition from neuron minds to module minds. This transition is also from unconsciousness to consciousness. It is momentous. So what is happening? What is so important about this transition that causes consciousness to come about? Well, it's this. So once you have advanced representational thinking between modules, so you've got your visual module looking at things, you've got a hearing module that's listening to things, a smell module smelling things, you've got your evaluation module saying, yes, this is food, is good, that mate is worth pursuing, oh, over there, that's poison, let's get away from it. These modules, as they get more powerful and each get more developed and specialized, they each become their own mind. They become, each module is its own neuron mind. And then the problem becomes, how do you decide which module should be in control of the mind at any given moment? Each of these modules is doing something different. The visual module might be saying, look, over there is some food. And the smell module would be saying, oh no, that stinks. That could be toxic. Let's get away from that. And the valuation module is saying, you know, I'm feeling romantic today. I need to find a mate. So how do you decide, how do these different modules work out? Which one of them takes control? The answer to this is consciousness. So in the module minds, the vertebrate minds, fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, mammals, they develop consciousness as a way to manage modules, as a way to manage which module should be in control of the entire mind at any given moment. Flies and insects did not develop this. They do not have the same need, and the difference is pretty simple. In insects, they can recognize and make predictions about patterns, but they can't recognize or make predictions about objects. This might seem like a subtle difference, but it's all important. So insects are terrific at identifying patterns, identifying and remembering patterns and evaluating patterns. They're terrific at it, but they aren't good at managing objects. A wonderful example of this is actually from the zebra. So the zebra's stripes, long been a mystery. Why does a zebra have stripes? It turns out it has stripes to defend itself against flies. So flies, they are baffled. They are bewildered by the stripes of zebras. So science research has shown that when flies try to land on zebras, I think about a third of the time or half the time, they bounce right off. Like the patterns confuse them. And that's because they're treating a zebra or a horse or any creature not as an object, but they're just processing the patterns on it. But when you get to the vertebrate minds, starting with the fish, when you get to the module minds, they start managing objects, but it's simply not possible to manage objects. To know, for example, this is a car, you know, whether I look at it from the left or the right or the top or the bottom, it's still a car. And if I close my eyes and I can hear the car's engine start up and recognize it's a car, that there's this thing that has all these different process, different properties, you know, visual properties, audio properties, that it's a thing. To manage that requires consciousness.
All right, Ogie, as we talk more about these module minds, we should chat about frogs, which their minds have interesting challenges. Unlike the creatures we've talked about previously that can move towards some desirable target, frogs can use their minds to calculate the difference between where they are and where they need to be to, say, catch a prey insect. What makes this mapping ability such a, pardon the pun, leap forward for frogs?
It is a leap forward. And what's so interesting about how frogs and all vertebrates, not just frogs, are able to target objects. So, for example, the way a frog is able to stick his tongue out and get an insect, or some frogs don't use their tongue. Some frogs just jump. They lunge at their prey. What's so interesting about the ability to target objects is it reveals how consciousness works. Because the process of targeting an object, like a frog targeting a bug, is not conscious. And understanding why this action is not conscious helps us make sense of conscious action. So what's going on in a frog's mind when it tries to jump towards a bug, jump towards a grasshopper, let's say? So as you pointed out, there's the frog mind compares two representations. And this is critical because all conscious experiences involve the comparison of two representations in the mind. But in this case, in the frog mind, as it's lunging towards a target, it's comparing two representations that do not become conscious. Why is this? What's the difference? What's going on? So when you're targeting an object, like a frog reaching for a bug, or the listener can imagine reaching out and touching their radio or their computer, that process, what's going on in your mind as you do that, is all unconscious. What your mind is doing is it's comparing a representation of the target. For a frog's mind, it's comparing a representation of the visual representation of the grasshopper it's trying to lunge towards, with a representation of the position of the frog. So it's comparing a representation of the location of the target to a representation of the location of the frog, and it's trying to make the difference between these representations go to zero. It's trying to make the gap go to zero. So in effect, it's constantly measuring the difference between these two representations and trying to drive that difference to zero. And when it gets to zero, the frog has hit the bug, or you have touched the computer or whatever you're reaching towards, and this mental activity stops. You've succeeded, you've hit your target, and that's that. Now this is very interesting, because I'm sure in a moment you'll ask me about some of these, the future minds that are conscious. And in those minds, we'll see they are also comparing two representations, but instead of trying to drive the difference to zero, it's trying to make the two representations match up. And this simple difference, this simple physical difference, is what's responsible for consciousness.
All right, Ogie, everything we've talked about so far, these increasingly sophisticated minds, they've all offered an advantage, right? None of this has been coincidental exactly. So what can we know about the reason for consciousness? If flies and amoeba can get by just fine without consciousness, why do other animals need it?
Great question. So that really underscores a really important lesson from the journey of the mind, is that each mental innovation always arose to solve a specific mental challenge. That is, every thinking function, every mental function that we have, every module that we have, every mental experience that we have, was designed to solve a specific mental challenge. And consciousness is no different. Consciousness emerged to solve a very specific mental challenge, and several challenges, in fact, but there's one key one above all else, and that we call the attention problem. And I've already sort of described it, but let me explain it a little more clearly. Is the problem that if you have an immensely complicated mind with billions of neurons, billions of neurons, dozens of modules, each doing their own thing. So a visual module, an audio, an auditory module, an emotion module, a navigation module, each doing their own thing. And there's no centralized decider. There's no neuron or circuit or module that's the president of the mind. How can the mind figure out who to give control to? Which of these modules at any given moment should take control of the mind? Consciousness solves that problem through resonance, as I described. Resonance is the physical dynamics, the physical mechanism by which consciousness solves the attention problem. This allows the mind to just, at any given moment, we always have inputs coming in. We have ideas in our head. You know, we have feelings. Maybe we had a fight with our significant other, and that's on, we're still feeling that. And we're talking to a customer service representative on the phone. You know, we always have so many different things coming into us. How does our mind manage to just to cut through this confusion and just get everything to focus on one thing? Again, it's resonance. Consciousness is a way to manage attention in the mind. Let me just say two quick other things that consciousness, two other problems consciousness solves. Consciousness also triggers learning. Whenever you're having a conscious experience, you're having a learning experience. Whenever a conscious state is happening, a resonance state, the module where the resonance state is happening is learning about the representation that's resonating. So your future understanding of that representation will be different. So again, if you're like looking at a pinwheel, you're conscious of the pinwheel, you're learning about the pinwheel. Your stored mental representation of all pinwheels is probably changing a little bit from learning this new one. So whenever you're aware of something, it doesn't matter what you're aware of, learning is going on in your mind.
So I'll confess, I picked up this book expecting to find my kind of mind and all the other human minds at the very end, when in fact you say there is something greater than the human mind. So tell us about that.
This is going to be difficult for many people to swallow, because yet again, it kind of displaces humankind from being, you know, the center of the universe, the most important thing in the universe. We like to think of ourselves, our own self, our brain, as the greatest and smartest creature on Earth. But the fact is, we individual humans were already surpassed by another mind millions of years ago, and that is the human supermind. Our own brains, our human brains, are completely designed as network router to function as network routers that communicate with other brains. So language is what gives our minds the ability to share attention with other minds. So all the minds in human society, all the minds in a city or a country, or if it's an Aboriginal people in an Aboriginal tribe, they're all sharing, they're all part of the same thinking, the same supermind thinking. The language that we speak and utter, and that your listeners are hearing you and I talk about, Chris, this is the thinking of the supermind, because the dynamics of language as it moves from human mind to human mind follows the same dynamics as the neural signals in our own brain. So once again, we see this embeddedness. Molecule mind, each neuron is a molecule mind, each module is a neuron mind, each human, individual human is a module mind, but the human supermind is in turn comprised of all these human minds. Humans cannot live without being connected to the supermind. If a human child is raised without language, it's a horror, it's a terrible thing. Sometimes they're called feral children, but whenever a child is raised without any exposure to language, including sign language is certainly a language, if they're not exposed to any form of human communication, not only do they grow up being unable to ever learn to talk or communicate, but they can't even function. They can't even survive on their own. They can't develop the basic, most rudimentary skills of survival. Again, because our brains, once we became parts of the supermind, we were no longer equipped to function on our own. We are all neurons yoked into the great human brain.
Do these insights, and I only have about a minute left to give you to answer this, do these insights tell you anything about the existence of free will?
Yes. So the journey of the mind suggests that free will exists. It's meaningful. We do not live in a predetermined universe because we have agency and purpose, and more specifically, because we have four layers of thinking: molecules, neurons, modules, supermind. And these layers allow us to escape the determinism of the lower levels of physics. And this implies that humans have the greatest free will, but it doesn't happen automatically. Free will only exists if you believe it exists. So I would encourage your listeners to believe it exists.
Ogi Ogas was a Department of Homeland Security fellow at the Department of Cognitive and Neural Systems at Boston University and a research fellow at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. His new book, written with co-author Sai Gadam, is Journey of the Mind: How Thinking Emerged from Chaos. Ogi, this has been so interesting. Thanks very much for making time for us.
Oh, I loved it, Chris. Thank you so much for having me on.
You can find us on Twitter at KERAThink and subscribe to our podcast free wherever you get podcasts by searching for KERAThink or listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.